Because church is not canceled, it's just not meeting. This is the Christian Education Podcast of New Dublin Presbyterian Church. I'm Sarah Jane Nixon, the pastor here, and joining me today is my dear friend Nate Brantingham, who graduated with me from Princeton Theological Seminary and is currently working in campus ministry at the University of Illinois. Thanks for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
So, we had, I had the great pleasure of being in class with Nate, and I heard this story as a part of one of his final exams, I think. And it's this fascinating and tragic story of a group that, a religious group, a church, that started off with really good intentions and just ended in insanity. Just crazy, 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 tragic end. And there are things I think that we can learn from them even today, and we'll talk about some of that at the end. But before we get started, Nate, would you kind of locate us in history?
Sure, yeah, and we'll also revisit your crazy comment, because while things did go off the rails, they really did think that they were doing things logically and with purpose. And so we'll talk about that. I'm not saying you're wrong. I'm just, from our perspective in history, it's easy to see it that way. From their perspective of history, it seemed to make a little more sense. So
where we're, that's part of why we can learn something from them, right?
Yeah, exactly right. Yeah. So anyway, so this took place. The story starts in 1534 and moves around that time period. It takes place in Münster, Germany, which is kind of west north of within Germany. It's kind of in the northwest section. And so what happens when this starts is that there's this radical guy named Melchior Hoffman. And Melchior Hoffman came out of the Anabaptist tradition. And so when we think about Reformation, we tend to think about the writers, and we think about Martin Luther, and we think about John Calvin and the things that they had to say. But there's another tradition called the Mennonite tradition, or Anabaptist, from which the Mennonites come from. So the Anabaptist tradition, which is less focused on one individual writer and more focused amongst a whole bunch of different writings, and it's more popular movement of Reformation. And most of it really draws heavily from Acts and the stories of the Gospels, and is very, very, very peaceful, nonviolent. It's very famous for being nonviolent. Their main collection of writings are just documents of martyrs telling their stories as part of court documents before they're put to death. And so that's where this tradition comes from. But Melchior Hoffman was really taken by the Old Testament and gave it a little bit different of a read, along the lines of thinking, well, yeah, you know, peacefulness is good, but a little wrath of God never hurt anybody. So, you know, maybe a little violence here and there is okay. And then started getting a little bit more apocalyptic in his visions. So the end is near, the end is at hand, that sort of thing. And he was operating out of this region. So people who were drawn to that style of thinking started kind of moving to that region. But Melchior Hoffman leaves our story at this point, and a guy named John Matthias takes over. And John is a follower of Melchior's and kind of continues this and brings this kind of to a fever pitch around the town of Münster. And the way... Yes.
Can you talk a little bit more, just to help people locate, who are the Anabaptists today? Who are the descendants of, not of these particular people, but of that tradition?
Yeah, so of the more like violent groups, they all kind of die out, so we don't have those. But of the very peaceful groups, we have Mennonites, we have Amish, and people of that tradition. Quakers are under Anabaptist umbrellas, if I understand right. So they're actually a really wonderful group. I really like the Anabaptists, and I really like their writings. Their martyr stories, if you get a chance to read them, are fascinating.
And if those of you who have listened to this podcast before, a couple weeks ago, we had Pastor Johnny Rashid on, who is also also part of this tradition, who was speaking to us about evangelism.
Oh, wonderful. Great. So that's the peaceful branch. So this is the non-branch we're going to look at today, right? But it's common route. It just goes in wildly different directions.
Exactly.
Okay, so our story, we're with John Matthias, who is in Munster, and he's drawing people to him who are of similar bent. And the way that the town is set up is that it's run by a bishop who is also the prince. So it's a bishop-prince mm-hmm. who runs it, and that's a Catholic authority. And under
I'm not
that,
sure the separation of church and state.
Yeah, right. Yeah, none of that. Very much entwined. And underneath that, and that's part of the corruption that these people are pushing back against. But anyway, underneath that, there was a group of elders, a town council. And what happened is enough people moved into the region who are followers of John Matthias that they were able to kind of do a bit of a coup on the town council and take over the town council. And once they had that, they started chasing non-followers off the town council and out of the town. And before long, they even chased out the bishop prince. So he leaves town. The people loyal to the bishop prince are leaving town. A lot of people start leaving town. Whether there's this other influx of people coming into the town who are followers. Now the take is at this time is that the bishop prince is going to raise an army, turn around and wipe them out very quickly because these are just a bunch of Anabaptists, right? What are they going to do? And this is against the entire force of the Catholic army. So this isn't going to last long. This is important because this is important because of this reason. When people left town, they didn't want their property unattended. So how they thought about it was, well, if I stay as a male, I will be conscripted or I will be killed by the invading forces when these people inevitably lose in like a couple weeks. So why don't I leave? And I will leave behind my wife who will watch over the property and is not likely to be conscripted or killed by the incoming forces. Mm-hmm. So kind of a win-win is how they thought of it. So the men left town and the women stayed behind. And that sets a stage for a very strange siege because the town is primarily women, but it's led by John Matthias and his followers. All right, so first assumption, this is going to be a real short-lived thing. There's no way these people can stand up against the might of the Roman Catholic army. They're going to hire a bunch of mercenaries, which they did, and they're going to wipe them out. So what happens is that there's a little bit of some raiding back and forth early on in the siege as things start getting established. And right near the start, our leader, John Matthias, gets killed in one of the raids. But instead of derailing this, we have a dog barking.
That's all right.
That's, life's happening. Okay. but instead of derailing because John Matthias gets killed, instead what happens is that the town council I was talking about, they reestablish themselves inspired by the Old Testament. They have a council of 12 elders who take over. And this is supposed to represent the 12 tribes of Israel. So they have their 12 tribes of Israel represented by the 12 elders, and all they're missing now is a King David to lead them. And so they go out to find one, and they find a man named John of Leiden, who is a tailor. And John of Leiden, this tailor, becomes their prophet king. He was a little bit of a prophet already, prophesizing about the end times and all this tradition. And they raise him up to be their new king, a la King David, backed by these 12 elders representing the 12 tribes of Israel. And from here, they start really hunkering in. So the mercenary army is like, well, let's just go wipe them out. So they charge to attack. But there's a bit of a difference, and one of them is that the mercenaries drank a lot. They took their money, and they bought alcohol, and they got wasted. The defenders, being stout religious people, did not drink, and they had guns, and they had walls. So the town of Munster it's a walled town. So there's the big town in the center, then there's a wall around the outside. And then outside of that wall is a pit filled with spikes. And then outside of that pit full of spikes is a second wall.
This town, they don't do anything halfway.
No, they do not. Their defenses were just incredible. And this was before they had enough cannon firepower to manage the walls. So these walls gave them this tremendous advantage. And they used it to absolutely destroy the mercenary army that was attacking them. Mm-hmm. And the mercenaries go running back. And these guys go back and there's some more radiance and back and forth. And it gets to this point where there's a stalemate, where they have enough force where they can easily hold off this town with its walls against the mercenaries. But they don't have enough where they can go attack the mercenaries and win. And the mercenaries have enough to if it's an even fight, they'll win. But as long as the walls are there, they're going to lose. Mm-hmm. So it sets into a stalemate. And so what the mercenaries decide to do is they're going to build a trench all the way around the entire town. And they're going to put in siege and they're going to stop the inflow of information and people and food. And they're going to starve them out before they go and kill them. So that means it's going to be a long, drawn-out siege, and it also means that in short order, this group and their ideas is cut off from the rest of the world and what's going on. They sneak out some missionaries to try to drum up some support. They had a vision that's all very Les Mis, that they're going to raise their banner, and the people, the populace are going to rise up, and they're going to come to them, and they're going to man the barricades, and then they're going to defeat the forces. That's what they believed was going to happen. Mm-hmm. But that didn't happen. The reinforcements weren't showing up, and so they just hunkered down. So once they hunkered down with this new leadership, they started putting into place a couple of reformations. And this is where the story, I think, gets really interesting. That's kind of the historical background that leads up to them being isolated. But what they do when they're isolated with their faith and their society is what's interesting. So the first thing that they do is they're reading the Bible very, very closely, and they know that this is important. So they institute schools to make sure that everybody can read and read the Bible. So that's the first thing they do. The second thing they do is they want to make sure that everybody gets fed. And there's some people who have a lot of wealth who are hoarding their food, and there's other people who don't have food. And so they institute an early form of communist socialism, and they go door to door with armed people, and they take all the food, and they bring it into one central storehouse where they can then distribute it fairly to everybody in the siege.
So they have good intentions here.
Their intentions were good, which is, we have poor people who aren't able to eat under a siege, and we must take care of them because that's what the Bible tells us we have to do.
And we want to educate people so that they can read. That's also great.
Right. So their intentions there are good. But here's where it goes sideways. So for example, so they get all the food together. Then they look at the food in the stockpile and they're like, wow, that's a lot of food. Because when you get a whole town's of food together, it's quite a bit. A lot of people left. We've got food for days. Let's throw a party. So they threw like 3 days of feast. And they ate a ton of the food, which, if you're in a siege, is not really the best idea.
Right.
Like, you should be, you're rationing this, but they just dove in. And part of the reason they did that is because they had this total belief that the reinforcements were going to come, both human and divine, that there would be a divine defense of their community as well, that God was going to come and defend them if nothing else. So their victory was inevitable. So at that point, why not eat the food? Because God's going to come save you anyway. So have at it. Mm-hmm. Right. So that's kind of where some of that goes a little sideways. But it continues in this one, and this is probably one of the most famous ones that they did. So working from that same proposition, God is going to come and defeat their enemies. But more than that, they had this apocryphal view that the end of the world was at hand. And what was going to happen was God was going to purge the earth of everybody not a true believer, which means everybody not them.
Right. Everybody not in the city.
Exactly. Everybody not in the city. And then the city is going to become a new Jerusalem and is going to inherit the promises given to Abraham. Mm-hmm. And they are to repopulate the world with believers. So not only going to win, but now that the whole world is going to be theirs, and they need to repopulate it because it's going to be empty because God will have killed everybody. So how do you repopulate a world? Well, you look around you and say, what do we got to work with? And I will remind you that all the men left. They all left town. At about the height of the siege, there were 2,000 men in the town holding it from the invaders, and between 8,000 and 9,000 women.
Wow.
So there was 4 to 5 women for every man. And they were supposed to repopulate the earth. So you can see where their thinking went. Mm-hmm. This is why God gave us all these women. So, right. Really, that's the thinking. You know, like, what was the hand that God gave us? Not that we were randomly dealt, but that God gave us. God gave us a handful of women. So that's how we're to do this. And this reinforces the obvious that this is what they're going to do. Mm-hmm. So you might say, well, wait a second. These women were married, and surely they don't want to commit adultery. But this branch of Anabaptists, Anabaptism meaning rebaptizing, you have to be rebaptized. Your baptism under the Catholic authority doesn't count. So you're rebaptized. So they rebaptize everybody. And when they did that, they were born again. And they thought that very literally, meaning contracts, including wedding contracts that you were signed before you were rebaptized, were invalid now. And everybody left behind. Your choice was be rebaptized or be killed. I should mention at this point that this John of Leiden, this tailor, prophet, king guy, had a bit of a propensity for cutting people's heads off. It was kind of his thing, especially early on. And it did cement his authority quite well. And it also guaranteed that everyone became rebaptized.
Right.
And so all those marriages were null and void, so now there are a bunch of available women. So they implement polygamy. But they do it with a strict set of rules, and the rules go like this. And again, the focus here is on repopulating the world. So the rules are this. If you're married and your wife is pregnant, you may marry another woman. If that second woman is pregnant, you may marry a third woman. But if now your first wife becomes not pregnant anymore, for whatever reason, you may not marry a fourth until your first wife now is re-pregnant, and then you can marry a fourth. So in other words, you can keep as many as you can keep pregnant at one time.
Oh man, these women.
Yeah, I know. It was not great, right? And it was not a good view of women. And but you can see their intentions.
Yes.
But then what happens is that there's a group of the men who are like, well, shoot, that means we can marry as many as we want. And so they just went door to door, like forcing women into marriage with them and trying to collect as many as they could get. And it was not good. I should point out that they also had rules for what to do if someone was too young, which was they were not eligible to be married. They were just to be protected. And if they were too old, they wouldn't necessarily enter into a marriage, but they could enter into a guardianship, because you still had to have the male head of the household. That's just the way they did things and did the food distribution. So you needed to be assigned to a man who would be your guardian. And then if you are barren, then you were excused from the whole must all be pregnant before you can remarry. But you also fell then into the guardianship role. Mm-hmm. So there was also what it means is that there is an element, at least in the writing of the document, that they thought about the people who were not fitting into that role and how to protect them and make sure that they got food and were valuable. They didn't just chase them out of the town or kill them.
Right.
They tried to put them into protective situation. So there it is. But it went south, right? As I was talking about with the guys going door to door, forcing women into marriage. And this went to the point where they forced women into marriage and into the bed who were under the age in the guidelines. And I tell you this only because it paints a picture also of what bravery looks like in repressive society, not because of what they did, but there was enough harm done by this group of people doing this that a woman in town became a doctor, which is unbelievable in its time already. Mm-hmm. She became a doctor, and she specialized in helping young children who were forced into these situations, and she would save their lives and take care of them. And she was became actually quite respected. And so her and other women raised enough of a ruckus to this king and the elders that this wasn't going as they intended, that what the king and the elders did is they put up a paper saying, if you sign your name on this piece of paper, you will be excused from your marriage. And this is a big deal, because this actually gives women the authority over deciding whether or not there's a divorce. Mm-hmm. So the women can decide to divorce their husbands. They're giving that authority to women, which is unheard of in the time. And part of that is because of the courageous work of this woman doctor. And she gets all of these children that she saves to put their names on the list. And other women do too, but here's the problem. This guy, remember, he has a propensity for beheading people who don't agree with him.
Right.
There's a lot of
bridging.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So there's a lot of women who think it's a trap, that he's trying to figure out who's not okay with his edict for polygamy. And so basically only the women who preferred the possibility of beheading over the marriage they were in signed up. And even then there was like 300-400 names that were on that paper. But they actually honored it. So women were given the right to decide and to have authority over divorce. And history doesn't report what happens really with them next. We get kind of spotty bits of history here. Not all information makes it out of the siege. We just know that that's kind of how that went. So that's a little bit of the about what was going on there. So the next thing I want to talk about is a little bit about what worship service sort of started looking like, and what happened in terms of the relationship between this person and the people in the town. And this is best told by 3 days of parties that they held as food was starting to run down, and he wanted to lift spirits back up and reinforce that everything was going to be okay. And so the first party that they had, they started eating some of the food that they had left. They dispersed the food. And they split this, by the way, into 3 days so that a third of the guard force could come each day. So either you were guard one day, rested the next, partied the next. So you got one out of three. So the first day, they have a feast and they have a mass, but it's kind of a Catholic mass, but it's not. It's done as a comedy to make fun of the Catholics and bolster. So it's kind of like a pseudo mass to make fun of the other religious tradition that they're fighting against. And they do this in the cathedral after they've kind of trashed it. And they've also started tearing down the smaller churches that they could reach because they're all Catholic, so they were no good. And there was a proclamation made that this church too would be destroyed by God as an earthquake for a sign. And that was a sign that God was going to come and help out with the fighting. So everyone was going to look for that. So that was day one, pretty mild. Day two was sort of the same in terms of the food, but instead of doing the mass, they did dancing. And that might seem a little strange because this is a group that's normally very against dancing. Mm-hmm. But they've been reading their Old Testament and they saw that David had music and did dancing, and they thought, well, shoot, maybe we should try that. So they did dancing, which they said, you know, if it was for like sexual reasons, you can't do it. But if it's for celebration of God stuff, you can dance. So here we have biblical interpretive dance taking place. And so that happened on day two. And then we get to day three, and he's trying to outdo himself, not sure what to do. He and the leader of the 12 elders start like prophesizing during the feast in front of people, and then the king starts foaming at the mouth and like falls over, possibly unconscious, and people aren't sure what's happening except these mumbling like prophecies. And so everyone's trying to figure out what's going on, and his best friend, the leader of the elders, is blessing people. But I should point out that the way he was blessing people, and he was only blessing women, was by kissing them. So make what you will out of that. And then the king, though, is not getting up. So everyone's thinking, is he dead? Mm-hmm. And so this guy is like, well, shoot, maybe he's dead. So I guess I'm king now. I'm king. and he sits on the throne. And everyone's thinking, this is the king who likes to behead people. If he gets up, you're totally dead. And so everyone's watching to see what happens. And then sure enough, the king gets up, and his best friend was like, haha, just kidding, you are king. And the king decides in his benevolence not to behead him, but instead to throw him in jail for a few days.
Okay.
And this is what they think they need to do in order to worship and celebrate their impending obvious victory in spite of the troubles which they are facing, is how they're seeing things. So it's very strange and very different, but you can see that it's flavored by kind of an understanding of wanting to do the right thing, kind of.
Mm-hmm.
It's strange, I know. So we'll go into some questions and some discussions. I'll just start, though, because from here the story wraps up pretty quickly. The reinforcements don't come. The siege tightens up. Eventually it does cut off the food completely. People start starving. They start running. But between the start and now, every time the mercenaries thought they had enough forces, they attacked. And each time that they were wrong and they got killed and humiliated over and over and over. And so at this point, when people started fleeing the town, the mercenaries were so angry that they just killed everybody who was running. Plus, they were Anabaptists, and so had to be put to death anyway. So women, children, men, it didn't matter. If they were leaving the town, they got killed.
Mm-hmm.
Except for a group of five people who somehow convinced them that they can get the army back into the city. So they say, hey, well, we were never really believers. We were just trapped there. Now we've come to you. We can help you win the city back. And it's not entirely clear how, but apparently they can get them back into the city. So they're able to open the gate somehow.
Mm-hmm.
And once the gate is open, then the advantage that the wall was given was taken away. They're already depleted by resources and people and starving. And so it's an absolute slaughter. And the mercenaries come in and kill everyone they can find. And that ends the siege. And what they do at the end is they kill John of Leiden, the king. They kill his number one, his bestie, who's named by Bernard Knipperdueling. It's kind of a fun name. And a third leader, whose name I can't remember off the top of my head, that they put each of them into a cage, dead, and hang them from the cathedral that they did these mock mass in, out the windows of the cathedral. And so once a year, if you choose, you can go to Munster and see the cages hanging on the cathedral as they celebrate this part of their history.
So there's not really, you know, there's not really a good guy in this story.
There's not, no.
It's a rough time in Christian history, and we don't want anybody listening to this to get the impression that we're saying, haha, Anabaptists and Catholics are terrible people, because that's, representative of either tradition, as we
right. say. Yeah, that's,
none of
that's,
these people survived the modern day. Any Anabaptist you know is not descended from these people.
Right. And the Catholics too have been reformed since then too. There's exactly. been Reformation after Reformation. So this is,
yeah, we say Reformation like it's one thing, but it's not.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So this is traditions that are quite removed from us.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But it doesn't mean that they're so removed that we can't learn things from.
True. And it's not a story without bravery. Like the woman doctor. Mm-hmm. And there are other stories of bravery as well built in and around this that are interesting. Mm-hmm. So
One of the things I think we talk about sometimes is we have a habit, you know, America tends to be fairly individualistic, and then
if
you add to that, we have some dominant narratives where, you know, what really matters is me and Jesus, or me and my Bible. And of course, having personal engagement and personal investment in the work of the Lord and in God is very important. But
right.
I think maybe one of the things we can learn is that isolation isn't necessarily a good thing. That we can't say only personal.
Yeah, you know, one of the first things that God ever says in Genesis is it is not good for humans to be alone. Mm-hmm. And it's said in that point in a very personal, you know, you and one other person. But Christ too says where people are gathered together. And so the gathering and the being together, I think if we look at it in a bigger picture, it's not good for a group of thought to be isolated from other groups of divergent thought, that somehow built in the system, differences of perspectives are important.
And not necessarily, you know, we don't have, and of course, in this period that we've been talking about, difference in perspective was, you know, something people went to war over.
Right.
You know, whether you could take communion or not was a prerequisite for whether you could be an ally in battle or not.
And right.
I'm very grateful that we have since moved past that period in our life. But yeah, what you say, you know, we read the Bible in church together, and we have public worship where all different sorts of people hopefully can come. And of course, we need to pay attention to making our churches places where different kinds of people can come. But then we also, you know, as much as possible, read the Bible with other churches, other traditions, other denominations. And aren't threatened necessarily when we disagree, because community keeps us from going off the rails.
Yeah, that's well put, right? Community is important, right? That can keep us on the straight and narrow, because this essentially turns itself into a cult, and an important part of cults and how they work is through isolation. They isolate their members from the outside world. Cults can't survive except in vacuum.
And that's true today as well.
Exactly. That's still true today. Yeah. So
God is wise when he gives us we say, you know, in the creed every Sunday, or the Nicene Creed especially, that we believe in one universal church. And that involves different people.
It did. And that was a statement that neither side of this would have agreed to.
Right. Or would have applied to each other, that you are.
Oh yeah, absolutely not.
You are outside the church,
right?
Yeah. So we need to be careful in saying who is and who isn't Christian, because as much as they're different from us, maybe they can teach us something, and they probably can teach us something.
Yeah, yeah. I wonder what these people could have been taught by, for example, the nonviolent Anabaptist traditions. If they've been more influenced by those, but who's to say?
Who's to know?
Yeah.
Well, is there anything else you want to say in closing, Nate?
Oh, this story is so fascinating. There's so many nooks and crannies. Even the way we get this story is fascinating, because documents that I based what I just told you on had been lost for most of history, from between when it happened to now. It was only rediscovered in 2006. Which in terms of like historical, that's a blink of an eye since then. So even a lot of this information is new to us. It's fascinating tale if anyone wants to look more at it. But I think for the purposes of what we set out to discuss, I think we've painted a good picture.
Thank you so much for joining us, Nate.
It's my pleasure. It's so wonderful to talk to you.
And if anybody might want to reach out afterwards, if they have questions, is there a email address they might could reach you?
Yeah, you could just email me at natebrantingham@gmail.com. So it's just like it sounds, Nate Brantingham, BRANTINGHAM @gmail.com.
Thanks for joining us, and thank you all for tuning in and listening.